John chapter 1. We're still in verses 1 through 4. I want to unpack the three participle verbs a little more. Tony, Jeff, and Mike and I were talking about this last week, and I think this is important to see because of what is going on today and because of us ourselves as Christians. Remember that when John wrote this, when he wrote his epistles, and when he wrote even the Gospel of John, John's not a young guy. He's not a young man. He's an old man. He's an elderly guy. Now, some people get the idea that since James and John and Jesus were cousins, as well as John the Baptist as well, that they were the same age, but that's not the case. Peter was the oldest of the apostles. Peter was at least 30 years old. Peter was probably about the age of Jesus, but the other apostles weren't. How do we know this? Because if you go back in the Gospels, remember there's a time where Peter comes to Jesus and asks him about the temple tax. Lord, should we do this? Should we pay this? And then, of course, the Lord gives him and tells him that, yes, we'll pay the temple tax. Temple tax now. And then when I'm wondering, how are we going to do this? And remember what Jesus tells Peter? What's that? You go find this fish. You go fishing. And then this fish, now is that a miracle or what? And in this fish, there's going to be a coin. And that will pay the temple tax for who? For you and me. So when what Jesus was signifying by that, and that is a miracle, by the way, Peter goes fishing and he gets that fish and he opens the fish's mouth and lo and behold, there's the coin. And it's enough, a drachma, it's enough to pay both the Lord's and Peter's temple tax, not the rest of the apostles. But why is that significant? Is because he was only paying for Peter was only paying for himself and Jesus, not the other apostles. What that signifies, what that means is that Jesus and Peter were the only ones old enough to have to pay that temple tax. In other words, they were 30. But the other apostles weren't even 30 yet. More than likely, Jesus' cousins, James and John and that, and the others were probably, they were probably in their 20s. Not teenagers yet, but probably in their 20s. But they weren't 30 yet. It was at the age of 30 that they would pay the temple tax. It's when they considered themselves in Judaism that they were adults, males, who had to pay for themselves. So John, all this time, all these many years, John's now an old man. Now there are some who teach, Mormons teach this by the way, that John never died. That's not what Jesus said. Jesus said, didn't say he would never die. He just told Peter, however long he stays, however long he is, you don't worry about that, Peter. You follow me. You follow me. And we know that from history that John, son of Zebedee, the Lord's cousin, one of the Lord's cousins, was the last of the apostles living. And he lived to an old age. Now, John writes 1 John probably about 95, 96 A.D. So we're getting up there, aren't we? Getting close to the first, into the first century. And you could think, all these years, John hasn't forgotten. John hasn't forgotten the Lord. He's remembering all these things. That's why it's significant to look at these participles and what John is saying here. The verbs that he is using. He says in verse 1, what was, and he uses the perfect tense, what was from the beginning. And again, last week, as I said, not who, but what. What was from the beginning. And when he's used the perfect tense, he is saying that it is a completed action, but it's continuing. It's going on. What was from the beginning. What we. Now that we, he's not talking about his audience. He's not talking about the other people in the other churches. He's not talking about us. He's not talking about all Christians when he says we. But he says, what we have heard, what we have seen, what we have handled, those need to be unpacked. Because again, it's all about word and life. Not bios life, not biological life, but zoe. That's a deep inner life, spiritual life. And when Jesus said that he was the life, when he said he was the way, the truth, and the life, when he said life, he said, Zoe. In other words, when he was saying that, he was telling them, I'm it. I embody all of life. It's what he says. John says, what we have heard, what we have seen with our eyes, what we have looked at, and what we have touched, what we have handled with our hands. Now, another word that he uses, what we have looked at, that word is often translated beheld. And we're going to get into those. Because again, this is important. Remember that John, when he's writing these epistles in his gospel, specifically these epistles, he is counteracting a false doctrine that is seeping into the church. And it's what came to be known as Gnosticism. Gnosticism is still with us today. And it's not just in the Seattle Gnostic Center and other Gnostic centers. Unbelieving or not, believe it or not, it is found in many churches today. A variety of Gnosticism. Now, the Gnostics believed that there were many gods, and there was one main god, and he was out there, and what he did is he produced emanations, what they call aeons. And Jesus was one of those minor emanations, or not minor, but major emanations that God created. And John is teaching against that. He's counteracting that. Their belief system. And see, they believed that Jesus wasn't really real. He was not someone that you could really see. He never was someone you could really see. Oh, he was there, but he's just a spiritual being. And he never died on a cross. Not literally. So when he said, we have seen, John is not using that in a figurative sense. The word that he used there, John is being very personal. It means the expression, what John is saying when he said, "We have seen," that means the apostles. That's what he's talking about. This is why the apostolic faith is so important. Why we have to adhere to apostolic Christianity. Because what the scriptures tell us, what is our faith based upon? The foundation. It's the foundation of the prophets and the apostles. What the apostles taught, what John is teaching here. So when John says what we have seen, what he means there is the expression of a literal historical fact. And again, the verbs are in the perfect tense. So what John is saying is, it was in the past, but it's an ongoing thing. It's a continual action here. And then he says, heard. And again, he uses the perfect tense. What he's saying is these things are to be taken not figuratively, not some hot pie in the sky by and by thing. Like we don't know what we're talking about, John is saying. John is saying that indeed, these things are to be taken literal. John is saying, we, the apostles, we were there. We heard him. We saw him literally. We saw him with our eyes. We didn't have to imagine him. We didn't have to think of him in some sort of aeon. He was actually there. John is saying, I can tell you by having heard him, by having seen him, what he's actually like. What the word is like. Now, when he says here what we have seen with our eyes, literally, what we have looked at, what we have beheld. Now, that word beheld or looked at, the word that he used there, it's very interesting. It doesn't just mean we looked at him. No. What it means, that word beheld. And what he's saying and looked at, what that word beheld means, it means steady contemplation. It means attentive viewing. What it is, what John is saying, is that we beheld, we looked intently. We looked at Jesus as if we would, of course they didn't in those days, but it would be like looking at Jesus, putting them on a slide and looking them under a microscope. That you're perusing them, looking at them that in intently. It's a deliberate and intentional looking in order to investigate. It's like what the biblical scholar F.F. Bruce said. They penetrated. He's talking about the apostles. They penetrated beyond what was accessible to outward vision to discern the inward glory. Now, John uses that in the aorist tense. He said, we beheld him. We did that. We looked at him and very deeply. It's another thing that goes back to John chapter 1. And the Word became flesh, and we beheld him. We beheld his glory. Now, glory, again, is another interesting word that's used in the Scriptures. It doesn't mean, people want to think, oh, glory means something marvelous, and, you know, something beyond description. That's what glory is. Well, yes, it is. But it's much more than that. Glory means character. The essence of a person. The glory, Shekinah, the glory of God, is not just how marvelous and how awesome he is, but it has to do with his nature and character. The same way with Jesus. When he says, we beheld him. John is saying that we look deep into him. We investigated him. And that's a lesson there for people today and for us today in the church. See? That we are to investigate. And then he says, touched, handled. Now the word John uses here means more than just to come upon a person and touch them. You know, like I would come up and touch Stuart. You know, just touch him. Okay, I touched them. I handled them. No, that's not what that means. That's not what John is saying. He doesn't mean just to go up to somebody. We just went up to Jesus and we touched him. And many people say, what do you mean they touched Jesus? No one could touch Jesus. Probably no one could touch Jesus and live. But they did. They literally handled, touched him. Jesus wasn't aloof. He didn't keep himself from people. Now that's what the Gnostics taught. He didn't keep himself from people. He let them touch him. And it was just his apostles we know as well. Syrophoenician woman touched Jesus' cloak and he said, power. He felt power go out from him. And his apostle looked around and said, all these people. Well, sure, Lord, somebody touched her. There's all these people around here. And then Jesus said, no, for I felt power go out from me. So that word handled or touch, what he's referring to, again, it has to do with that beheld. It means that they examined Jesus so closely. They investigated him so closely that they did it, but literally also by touching him. But touching him in a very deep way. Why was John known as a disciple whom he loved? Sure. Now, it wasn't just because he was Jesus' cousin, but it was because of John's character. Remember? John's thinking, here he is an old man, but he's going back years, and he's probably thinking about the times that indeed he had touched the Master. The time when in the garden, before the Garden of Gethsemane, they're in the upper room, the Lord's Supper, and it says he reclined on the Lord's breast, right? Chest. He did that literally. He was touching the Lord. John puts great emphasis upon these words. Heard, seen, handled, beheld, handled, touched. He puts very much emphasis on these. Why? Because it's as Brother Reese says, Gareth Reese says, their testimony, the apostles, their testimony concerning him was based upon verifiable historical facts. Not on speculation or fabricated fables, as was the testimony of the Gnostics. Why is that important, brothers and sisters, today? Because many people want to teach that this is not historically verifiable. It is not facts. It's not facts about Jesus. He cannot be historically verified. What they want to say is that it's all subjective. But John is coming back to the objective. He's destroying those people who would not believe. in the literal historical fact that Jesus lived, died, buried, and rose again. And John can say, wait a minute now. We did. We have. And it's again, as I said in verse 1, where it says, concerning the word of life, that should be rendered instead this way. What it literally says in the Greek, it should be rendered concerning the word which is also life. He's not word of life. Well, he is that too. But more importantly, he's word and life. Not just the word of life, but he is word and life. Concerning the word which is also the life. John uses a double, what we call a double genitive here. Which brings us again to verse 2, which is also important. And he says, the word which was also life was manifested. Now, manifested is another favorite word of John that John likes to use. John uses what we call a parenthetical explanation of what he said in verse 1 and verse 2. And then he's going to return to what he's saying in verse 3 and 4. And I remember, as I said last week, this is in the Greek, this is one long sentence with four relative clauses embedded in within it. And the life was manifested. Both, you find this, John uses this frequently both in the Gospels, in the Epistles, and in Revelation. When you look at that word manifest, now here he uses the aorist tense, and the life was manifested. Past tense, was manifested. What does he mean by that? Goes back to what John says in John 1, verse 31. And remember what he said in verse 14 of John 1, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we saw his glory. Glory as of the only begotten, we beheld his glory. Glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. That's talking about his nature and character. Now, if you look at John 1:31, notice what John says there. Of course, John the Baptist is the one that's talking. I did not recognize him, but so that he might be manifested to Israel, I came immersing in water. And then you find it also at the end. There's other places in John, that he uses the word manifest, but these are two of the most important in John 1:31, and then John chapter 21, verses 1 and verse 14. He says, after these things, Jesus manifested himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias, and he manifested himself in this way. And then in verse 14, this is now the third time that Jesus was manifested to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. So what's significant about that? That word manifest? John is saying Jesus, who he is, who he was, who he is now, was manifested to us objectively. When John used the word manifest, he uses it in an objective sense, not subjective. John is saying what he is doing here, that it manifest means it is something done by someone else outside the observer, which the observer, the apostles and his disciples, but specifically the apostle, is then able to see and experience. What does that mean? Again, if you look at John chapter 14, verse 6, Jesus said, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. What Jesus was saying by that, and what John means by manifest, is this. This is a warning. This is a warning to those who would elevate, and many are doing that today in the churches. And it's a danger, a temptation to all of us as Christians. And that is to elevate our subjective, if you want to term it that way, to elevate our subjective religious experiences. And that's what many people are doing today. Do you feel them? Do you feel the Spirit? Do you feel Jesus? You don't? Well, why not? Isn't that what we're supposed to do, is to feel him? And see, they use that in a subjective sense. Oh, I really felt the presence of God today in after worship. I really felt his presence. Really? How did you feel his presence? Oh, that music, you know, that was up there. Oh, and the preaching, man, I tell you what, man, that just blew me over. So I felt the presence of God. I felt his presence. But see, brothers and sisters, that's subjective things. And what John is saying here is that Jesus was manifested. Do we understand really what this means? John is affirming that what the apostles saw, what was manifested to them. Do we understand what he is saying here? That you and I, that the apostles could have not known who God was and who he is, his true nature and character, unless Jesus chose to manifest himself. What does that mean? Goes back to this. Jesus said he came to do what? The Word became incarnate, became flesh. To do what? Jesus said he came to show and to explain God to them. That's why after all those years, when Philip came to him on behalf of the other apostles too, because they were thinking the same thing. And remember Philip comes to him and said, Lord, show us the Father. Show us Yahweh. We want to see God. That's what they were saying. We want to see Yahweh in Jesus. You can imagine him. I can imagine even tears coming. Doesn't say that, but I can imagine that. Because Jesus, what the scriptures tell us in the Greek is that Jesus was very moved by that. And Jesus said, oh, you can just imagine him saying it this way. Oh, have I been with you so long? Have I been with you so long and yet you still don't understand? He said, if you have seen me, If you have seen my manifestation, if you have seen me, you have seen the Father. You have seen Yahweh. You have seen God. What Jesus was saying is, I have manifested. I have shown. I have explained. I have described him to you. And brothers and sisters, that is an objective thing, not subjective. And people want to put their Christian faith on a subjective level. And they forget about the objective. But our faith is objective. He did come and explain God to us. John is affirming here. Contrary to what the Gnostics taught, that the apostles did what the Lord commanded them to do. Jesus said, I came to show, I came to explain the Father to you. I have done that. Now Jesus says, I want you to teach others that you know those things. That you don't only know about me, but you know me. Because why? Because you heard, you saw, you touched, you handled, you beheld. And through all those things, I was manifested to you. And God, the Father, was manifested to you. That's what he's saying. See, and that's why this is so important for us today. And it is the basis of what John says here in verse 3. What we have seen and heard, we proclaim to you also, so that you too may have fellowship with us. And indeed, our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. These things we write so that our joy, the apostles, may be made complete. Now, John uses what we call in verse 3 here a purpose clause, a henna clause. And he uses the present subjective, and it means we not only have it, but we continue to have it. But what is that basis, see, of fellowship? This is what I was talking about last week, that many people, many Christians no longer believe today. The basis of that fellowship is what John has said above, the word and the life, that Jesus is that. But the basis of the fellowship, brothers and sisters, is exclusive. That's what many people in churches and what many Christians do not want to believe today. That Jesus is exclusive. It's talking about the exclusive character of Christ as the Word and life. People want to say, well, it doesn't matter what tribe you belong to, just as long as you say that you're of him and that you believe in him. No. John says, no, you can't do that. John is saying, you cannot be a Gnostic and have fellowship with us. You cannot be a Gnostic and have fellowship with God. You cannot be a Gnostic and have fellowship with Christ. It also means that you cannot be a Buddhist and have fellowship with us. You cannot be a Buddhist and have fellowship with Christ or with God. You can't be a Hindu and have that. You cannot be a Muslim and have that. We do not worship or serve the same God, the same Yahweh. Jesus is exclusive. And John is talking about the exclusive character and nature of Jesus And that's the basis of our fellowship. And brothers and sisters, if we don't believe in that, then we're not following him. That's what he meant. That's what Peter meant when he said, there is salvation and no other name under heaven by which we can be saved but that of Jesus. That's what Jesus meant when he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. And it's not just saying, oh, I believe in Jesus. But I can also be a Hindu, I can be a Buddhist, I can be a Muslim too. You know that that teaching is going around out there today? You can say Buddhist Christian, you can say Hindu Christian, you can say Muslim Christian, or any other type, whatever you want. Just add Christian to it. And Mike knows me. Mike, we're talking about that. You can't do that. And that's what John is getting to. That is exactly what he's saying. To deny the exclusive character of Jesus is to destroy the only basis that we have to have any communion with Christ. To have any intimate communion with the Father. Brother Gareth Reese says, and I so heartily agree with him, Christian fellowship is possible only on the basis of a common belief in Jesus. And what he means by that, and what I mean by that, is not just saying, I believe in Jesus. Yeah, he was a great one. He was a prophet. Oh, yeah, okay, if you want to say he's Son of God, okay, he was Son of God. See, we all believe in the same Jesus, don't we? No. Not true. And that's what John is saying. And Christian fellowship is only based upon these things. And that's where we move on from there. Now, when John says we there, he's being very emphatic. He's emphasizing. John is saying that not only our fellowship, but our joy depends on these things. On these things that we believe. But it involves obedience to the commands of Christ and faithfulness to his teaching. So that sets John's agenda for these epistles. And it sets our agenda as well as we continue on in our Christian life. Because no matter what others want to say, brothers and sisters, no matter what the world may want to teach, it is Christ. It is Christ Jesus that separates us from the world and the teachings of the world. And it always must, contrary to what the world wants to do to us and wants us to believe. That's why it's important. We're going to stand, we're going to sing, take the name of Jesus with you. We sing that song, take the name of Jesus with you. But that entails a lot of things within it, doesn't it?